Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome to True Crime, the podcast that helps you find new, emerging, and undiscovered true crime podcasts. I'm Greg, the host and curator of True Crime. Today's episode is from Scary Savannah and Beyond. Scary Savannah and Beyond is a Savannah-based podcast talking about the paranormal, true crime, and oddity stories. Podcasting from the most haunted city in the USA, Savannah, Georgia. If you like today's episode, make sure to check out the episode description for links to subscribe. All right, let's get this show started.
Begin.
Welcome to Scary Savannah and Beyond. This is going to be episode number murder mystery slash possibly accident.
Possible. Drowning. Who knows?
Otherwise known as episode 60. So, Crystal, please tell me, how have you been this fine week?
I'm great.
Perfect. This has been Scary Savannah and Beyond. Please tune in 2 weeks when we further expound upon how good she's doing.
Oh, we had a great Christmas. It seems like it's been a while now, even though it's only
been weeks.
But it hasn't. Has it?
Yes.
Weeks. Well, it's just we've been doing so many things.
We're very busy people. Yeah. We got things going on.
Yeah, so the family came. It was fun. Then we went to a fancy dinner at Vix on the River for my birthday. We had our first macaron.
We did. And don't confuse that with macaroon, because it's not the same thing.
Yeah, macaroons totally are different. Coconut.
And they don't look at all like
the cute
macaron.
Little round macarons.
And I'm going to act like I didn't know that there was a difference at one point, but I did know because they are completely different creatures. And we have discovered that macarons are one of our favorite things now.
Yeah, and, but we can't eat them very often because they're just sugar.
Pure sugar.
Yeah, so we just got a little sample box and tried it. It's just one more thing you've learned from all these baking shows I make you watch.
That the worst cook always wins.
I'm talking about macarons.
Oh, I haven't tried to make those yet. But they, when you bite into it, the texture is nothing like what it looks like it would be. And I could see why it would be very difficult to correctly make it.
Hey, we've seen 8-year-olds make it on that.
But they have their own businesses. All of them. And the kids' baking challenge, it's like you got these little 6-year-olds. Yes, I've been in business for the past, 8/10 of my life. And I sell macarons and I make them every day.
I'm sure that's what you'll want to get into next.
I've already got a plan.
Well, we've still got the Christmas decorations up. So we just...
except for in here.
Well, yeah, this is the only room I've gotten to. So I'm just trying to enjoy them.
It took you all day to
just
get this room out. I can't imagine what it's going to be like to get the rest of the house.
Well, we did get a bunch of totes last night, so I'm prepared.
Way to go, Home Depot.
And for New Year's, we went to our daughter Kylie's house and played ping pong.
That was a lot of fun.
And we watched the Georgia Bulldogs win at midnight. It was amazing.
Yeah, with a shanked kick by Ohio State. But we'll take what we can get.
Yeah, now they're going to the championship.
And this episode should air the day before the national championship, if everything goes according to plan.
It should.
So, go Dogs.
Go Dogs. And we've had some much-needed time off from the podcast since we're going to our bi-weekly release schedule. This is going to allow us to spend more time researching the stories and putting out even better content and putting a little more focus on Patreon.
Well, really, all it's done for me is allow me to create avenues to spend more time on other things.
Yeah, now you've got your album you're
That's
working
right.
on.
I'm hoping it comes out soon. And by soon, I mean within the next 6 to 7 years.
And your your podcast.
I've got a new podcast I'm going to start. It's an audio drama, probably horror-ish. I already have a name for
it. You come up with a name and you've bought a website.
I don't want to reveal what it is yet, but so, I do have a name. I do have a website. I do have social media links. I got all that locked down and I've begun to write the script.
You have.
So if anybody would like to be a voice actor in a podcast and you think you got the skills to do it, hit me up.
Yeah, save me from having to be all the female characters in the play.
She's got to be the females. She's got to be the camels. She's
got to
be the penguins. She's also got to be like chirping birds. I'm not sure how she's going to do that, but that's not my problem.
Okay, so I'm excited to dive into this week's episode, and this one takes place right here on Tybee Island.
If you didn't know, we actually live on Tybee Island, which is about 30-ish minutes away from downtown Savannah. If I'm driving, mm-hmm. if she's driving, she can get there in 15.
Yeah, I was able to get us here from Rinkin an hour away to see the fireworks
just
at midnight.
In time.
Got if you just did in it, time. We would have been late.
We'd still be there.
We would definitely have not made it.
But I bring that up to say this is our home, so this story, we didn't even know it existed, but she's dug up some interesting stuff.
Yeah, so we were at dinner with some friends a couple weeks ago, and Brett was being his normal chatty Cathy self.
Not at all.
And he asked what the restaurant we were sitting in used to be like. He was wondering, because he wonders. I call him The Wanderer.
That's the name of my first album, so The Wanderer.
We knew that it was formerly the post office many years ago, but when we moved here, it was empty. But it's since been turned into a nice seafood restaurant called Pier 16.
We've been there multiple times.
One of the friends we were having dinner with, who has been on Tybee a lot longer, said she remembered it being a doctor's office back in the early 2000s, and that the doctor's wife had died under mysterious circumstances. And there were rumors of cocaine hot tub parties.
When she said that, her husband sitting beside her, who's a lawyer, said, "How come I wasn't invited?"
So how could she have not thought to share this info with us sooner? I guess
she doesn't really understand what the concept of our podcast is.
Yeah, I guess it just didn't occur to her. So I was intrigued. And as soon as we got home, I started researching. And this is truly a fascinating case. This is the mysterious death of Joni O'Shaughnessy. Joni O'Shaughnessy was born Joni Marie Burgess in Savannah, Georgia in 1959. She met Dr. Charles Owen O'Shaughnessy, who we'll call Owen. That's what he went by.
Is that what we're just going to call him? Well, we're going to call him Owen.
Well, we're not going to call him Charles, which is his first name.
Because nobody called him Charles.
They called him Owen, from what I've gathered. Well, they met in a bar at the Bay Street Inn in Savannah in the early 1990s. Doesn't everyone?
That's still there, isn't
it? Okay. It is. Dr. O'Shaughnessy, who lived in Detroit, Michigan at the time, was in town to give a lecture on pain management. Owen was born in Dublin, Ireland, and graduated from the University College Dublin in 1968. Joni and Owen really hit it off, and according to Joni's mother, Joni found the doctor charming, funny, and intelligent. Dr. O'Shaughnessy described Joni as, quote, an utter charmer, saying, quote, she could keep people laughing. The more I knew her, the more extraordinary she could be. End quote. Needless to say, they kept in touch when Dr. O'Shaughnessy returned to Detroit. He wrote to her daily, and this led to Joni ending her already troubled first marriage. According to Joni's friend Claire Bryant, quote, she thought he was her soulmate, end quote. Joni moved to Detroit, and they married in 1992, but the couple soon decided to move to Tybee Island, which is a barrier island right outside Joni's hometown of Savannah. Tybee is an eclectic community full of people from all walks of life. Doctors, lawyers, artists, musicians, and service workers all come together and enjoy a life full of sunny days and late nights.
That's a perfect description of this town / island.
It's a great place to live. If you come to Tybee, you'll get it. It's like no other place. And overall, it's a safe place to live. The murder rate, from what I could find, is close to zero.
I can't recall ever hearing about somebody being killed out here since we've been here.
Right. I did find a murder-suicide from 2015 involving two people who were here visiting.
That was before we were here.
Yeah. And they didn't live here. Most of the crimes that occur here are theft, so always lock your car, and public drunkenness. That just goes with the territory.
Pretty much happens when you've got more bars per capita than Los Angeles. Yeah.
But overall, Tybee is a safe beachside retreat to live and work. Joni and Owen thought Tybee would be a great place to start their new life together. Owen tried to obtain board certification as well as a psychology certification to start a hospice, but he was unsuccessful. Instead, he opened Tybee Island Medical Clinic on the south end of Tybee in 1993. It was the only medical practice on Tybee at the time and was located at 1601 Inlet Avenue, which is where the restaurant Pier 16 is now. We don't have a medical facility out here these days. We have to go off island.
If you want to see where this place was located, if you ever visit Tybee Island, you always have to make a left turn onto the main strip, which is called Tybreesa, and you just look off to the right, and you'll see a restaurant, two-story restaurant sitting right there. That is where this happened.
And back then it wasn't two stories. They built on top of there to put the deck up there.
Yeah, they did. I remember that. Mm-hmm. People complained about it around here because their intention was to put music and they're going to be so loud, even though all those houses in that area are vacation rentals.
Yeah, and even though all the other bars play music. So
yeah.
It seems like he didn't open up the practice to get rich. It seemed like he just wanted to enjoy the area and help people. He is quoted as saying, quote, "You give me a chicken, I give you penicillin," end quote. And I'm assuming this means he would barter for medical services.
Sounds reasonable, unless maybe that's like some code that people would use around here that we don't get yet.
Well, no, I mean, there are accounts of some people not being charged for services. So I think he was, you know, if
pretty well-liked kind of guy around here then, I imagine.
I think so. If you needed help, I think that, you know, this wasn't a get-rich endeavor.
Yeah.
He said they never made much money, and friends say they weren't good at managing the money they did make.
Okay.
They settled into a cute little beach house on Miller Avenue, and I found a picture of the house from the paper. We're going to put it on the screen now, and it'll be in our social media. And we also went by there and took a picture of what it currently looks like today.
And here's that picture.
But unfortunately, their new life in paradise did not go as they had hoped. Both Owen and Joni were battling their own demons. Owen suffered from bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder is formally known as manic depression. Sufferers experience extreme highs and extreme lows, and it's important for those with this disorder to take their medicine consistently. However, Owen was treating his disorder on his own, which is a no-no. And he did not take the self-prescribed medication as intended, because he didn't like the side effects. This led to massive mood swings. And I'm not sure if he had actually been diagnosed by another physician in the first place or if he had self-diagnosed himself, but he wasn't under the care of another physician. And that's a big problem.
Almost sounds illegal.
It is. It goes against their board of
ethics,
medical ethics. Joni was all about the Tybee nightlife. She loved to party and hang out with friends, and unfortunately, she had a drug problem. Owen, being a doctor, facilitated her addiction by prescribing her pills such as OxyContin.
Not good.
OxyContin is a powerful narcotic that is intended to treat pain, but when it's abused, it can mimic the effects of heroin. OxyContin tablets have a control release feature, so it's designed for you to take it whole.
Yeah.
But if you crush it up and you can snort it, or dissolve it in water and inject it, and that bypasses.
So it basically just all hits you at one time.
Yeah, it bypasses that control release feature, so that's not good. And I don't know.
If it's something that has a controlled release, it must mean that it's super strong, so you don't want to get hit with all the effects of it immediately, and you want it to slowly over time release to mitigate pain.
Yeah, so I don't know if she did that or if she just took them normally, but usually people who become addicted to it,
because they want to
get it faster.
Fast.
Owen's clinic was known as a go-to place to get prescription meds, and he was dubbed by the locals as Dr. Feelgood, likely a reference to Max Jacobson, the doctor who injected a cocktail of amphetamines and steroids into celebrities such as Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, Frank Sinatra, and President John Kennedy. And that's actually an interesting story I might go into at some point, too. They're saying, you know,
I thought it was
changed
just like
history.
An Iron Maiden album.
No, it is an album. I think there's a band by that name also.
There might be more than, I imagine there's a lot of people that use that term.
Yeah.
Or is it Alice Cooper?
I don't know. He had a huge impact on
If you know, let us know, and we might reward you with just talking about you.
People from out of state would come to the clinic on Tybee to get prescriptions from Dr. O'Shaughnessy. Owen didn't fit into the Tybee lifestyle, according to those that knew the couple. He was not outgoing like his wife, and many times he went home without her. Marijuana was his drug of choice, and he preferred to smoke it at home alone rather than with his wife's friends.
That, you may not know, is actually the state flower of the capital of Tybee, because a lot of people around here consider Tybee to be its own little kingdom. Like, they don't even view it as part of Chatham County. They're like, once you cross the bridge, you're in Tybee.
Yeah.
So everybody out here is just freely walking around smoking, it seems.
I see it was a big deal back then, but now it's decriminalized, so it's not a felony, but it was a felony at this time.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Not so much now.
Yeah. Owen admitted to resenting his wife's social skills. He was jealous of her innate ability to be the life of the party. The couple often fought over money and her partying and drug use. So why is he prescribing her pills?
It seems like maybe he was probably doing it just to keep her happy.
I think
maybe to keep her with him.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it was. Her friends say her drugs of choice were cocaine and heroin. The relationship between Owen and Joni continued to decline. Joni even contacted a divorce attorney, but told friends she didn't actually intend to go through with it. She just wanted to scare him. But he claimed that he didn't know anything about this possible divorce until after her death. Fights between the couple escalated, even becoming physical at times. Then in July of 2002, Joni was not doing well physically or mentally. After returning from a trip to Central America, she found she had E. coli in her lungs.
Well, that is not good.
Mm-mm. The couple was so at odds that he refused to treat her condition. Her mother, Becky Crawford, had to drive her to Twin City, Georgia, which is about 2 hours away, to be treated by another physician. Her mother stated that Joni was afraid of Owen. Joni is clearly upset that he refuses to help her, and in a letter she wrote on the back of a pamphlet from the medical clinic, she says, quote, "This is bad, this is wicked, evil, hateful, destructive, willful badness. If you believe in sin, and some tiny Catholic part of you still does, you're skating right up to the edge of a huge one. There's no way I will avoid this just, hard punishment that you've been polishing, nurturing, saving up for me for so very, very, very long. This is revenge. This is righteous retribution. Here's the tricky part. How? I've got a plan now, and all you need to do is simple. Let me sleep. No drama. No drugs or razors. Peaceful. Easy. Just wait. Withhold. I will go away. Disappear. Honest." End quote.
That is very dark.
This letter is dated sometime in July of 2002, and it sounds like she's really suffering and possibly suicidal, but her friends and family say she was very much against suicide. One of her friends, Belinda Flanagan, said Joni would never kill herself, and other friends said that anytime she heard about someone completing suicide, she would cry because she believed life was precious.
Okay.
So that may be true, but we never really know what's going on in someone's head, and I'm not suggesting that she was suicidal. Maybe she just wanted to vent and say the things she was thinking, but really didn't have intentions of taking her life.
Probably it was just something to try to get feelings out, and because I know of people that will say things that they never intend to do, but they feel like it's going to be the most impactful thing they could say in the situation. So perhaps that is what that was related
to. I don't even know that she gave him the letter or if they just found it after the fact. You know, maybe she was just venting and didn't intend for him to read it. I don't know. And I'm sure she was in a lot of pain with the infection, and she felt like he was betraying her by not treating her. So it was a lot going on. Despite their tumultuous relationship, the couple decided to try to work things out and have a fun night out in Savannah as sort of a reconciliation date night. On July 31st, 2002, Joni calls a friend named Linda Hyde Chubakis. When questioned later, Linda said Joni was looking for cocaine or OxyContin. Owen claims that Joni was complaining of suffering from anxiety on this day, so he called her in a prescription for 30 tablets of lorazepam at the CVS on Whitmarsh Island.
That sounds like a lot.
Well, she wasn't intended to take them all in one day. You don't just call in
one pill.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Lorazepam is a benzodiazepine that works in the brain to relieve symptoms of anxiety. It's similar to Valium. On the way to Savannah, the couple picked up the prescription, and Owen said he told her to take one tablet. At around 8 p.m., the couple arrives at the Westin Hotel, where they watched a band play.
Hey, isn't that the place where all the Rat Pack was at?
I think it is. This is the one on the other side of the river, if you're standing on River Street.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of Wilmington Island.
And this is downtown on the river, if you're looking across.
On the South Carolina side.
Mm-hmm. After this, they went to McDonough's Bar, which is located downtown Savannah.
We've been there.
Mm-hmm. They have a couple drinks, which Owen pays for with his SunTrust debit card. The total was $16.90. He says he puts the debit card back in the front shirt pocket of the shirt he's wearing that
night. Well, he wasn't a big tipper, was he?
Maybe they just had one drink each, so
okay,
that could have been a decent tip back then. This is a while ago.
Oh, yeah, that is true.
Around 11 p.m., Joni drives them back to their home on Tybee Island. Owen says he went to bed around midnight, and Joni went out to celebrate a going-away party with friends at Rascal's Bar. Going out at midnight may sound odd to most people, but here on Tybee, the parties can last till 3 a.m. when the bars close.
Usually, and I was in a band, and we would play at bars on Tybee and in Savannah, and we didn't really like, they always wanted you to start around 8. mm-hmm. at most places. And you're like, you don't really want to do your good stuff because people don't really start coming in until like 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so just getting started.
That's where it sort of begins, really.
Yeah. Rascal's Bar is no longer here, but I was able to find out where it was located. And it was on Butler right beside the Breakfast Club. And we have a pic of the building where it was. So I don't think there's anything in it now but storage.
But here's a picture nonetheless.
So it was right in the middle of all the nightlife and quite a walk from their home on the north end of Miller Avenue. It doesn't say if she walked or drove down there, but most people walk to and from the bars if they're planning to be drinking.
Plus, also, if it's that long of a walk, because our island's not that big, but that is a long walk, even if you're sober.
It really is. Joni's friends confirmed that she was at the bar until 3 a.m. She had one beer and did not appear to them to be intoxicated, but they did say she seemed down and not quite like herself. When the bar closed at 3 a.m., Joni was seen by a friend, Irene Daigle, walking in the direction of Doc's Bar, which is the opposite direction of her home.
My band's played there several times.
Irene says she saw Joni talking with the woman that appeared to be Linda Hyde Chabakas. And Chabakas later denies that she was on Tybee that night. This is that friend that Joni called earlier in the day asking about cocaine and OxyContin.
Okay.
According to Owen, Joni arrived home around 3:30 a.m. in a rage. So if she left at 3, it seems like she would have walked if it took her 30 minutes to get home. Because it's not a 30-minute drive.
That's a pretty fast walk.
But it's not a 30-minute drive.
It is not. No. It's like a 3 to 5-minute drive.
So she must have walked. So she arrives home in a rage.
Or she might have rode a bicycle.
That's also true. He wasn't sure what she was mad about, but he claims he locked himself in their bedroom. He says Joni grabbed a hammer and broke a hole in the door and unlocked it. He says at the time, he starts putting his clothes on, and he puts on a pair of khaki pants and a t-shirt. Owen says Joni then came around the bed repeating the phrase, quote, I need to get it. He doesn't know what she's referring to. He grabs his keys and leaves the house. He walks along the beach all the way to his office on the south end of the island. And this is a fairly good walk. I'd say at least 30 to 40 minutes along the beach.
Yeah, because walking on the beach takes longer than walking on the sidewalk, for sure.
Mm, we've walked that a lot of times.
Plus, it also curves around. But the beach used to be a little different. If you remember before they renourished it, it was sort of, it changes. The Tybee Beach changes over time.
And at 9 a.m., now it's August 1st, 2002, Jennifer McAllister, who is the assistant at the medical facility, arrives at the office to find a disheveled Dr. O'Shaughnessy. She says he was wearing the same clothes he had on the day before, khakis and a white dress shirt and colorful tie, so not the t-shirt that he's claiming he put on.
Okay.
He tells Jennifer that he and Joni had a fight and that it was, quote, the worst we've ever had. Around 9:30 a.m., a friend of the couple calls the O'Shaughnessy's residence, but the line is busy. At noon, Jennifer McAllister goes to the home on Miller Avenue, but finds it locked. This is unusual because Tybee isn't a place where you always need to lock your doors, especially in the middle of the day. She found that unusual. And she tried calling out to Joni through a window where they had an air conditioner, but got no response. And Jennifer says, quote, I got a chill and ran to my car and left. At 2 p.m., Owen and Jennifer return to the O'Shaughnessy home to retrieve the clinic's checkbook. Owen helps Jennifer enter through a window, and she unlocks the door for him. He had stated that he took his keys with him when he left that night, so I'm not sure why he didn't use them to open the door, unless he left them at the clinic
or
he forgot.
Maybe he just left them at the clinic. But then how did they get back to the house?
They walked. Maybe they took her car.
Okay.
I think they took her car. And so she says that they grabbed the checkbook and a money bag and were about to leave, and they didn't see Joni. And Owen asked her if she checked the bathroom. So he goes into the bathroom and finds Joni dead in the bathtub.
Oh, no.
Jennifer says he came out of the bathroom with wet handprints on his pants, and she calls 911. Before the police arrived, Owen used a key to open a door, the back door, to get rid of a can containing marijuana. It's unknown if this was the key that he took with him or one that he already that was already in the house.
That just seems weird that that's something you're going to think about when your wife was just found
that's
dead in the bathtub.
That's what I was thinking. But, you know, it is a felony and he is a doctor. So that, you know, finding illegal drugs in your home is a problem.
Oh, I'm sure it's a problem. But I think if the same situation happened to me, I wouldn't have the presence of mind to care about things like that.
Yeah.
Which I can't judge other people because not everybody's brain works like mine.
Yeah, but I did find that odd. And at 2:30 p.m., Tybee police and paramedics respond to the home and an investigation begins. Owen told Jennifer, quote, "I think she took too much Valium because I had just called her in the Valium the day before this happened." So that's the lorazepam. Told you they're similar.
Okay.
So he's like saying he thinks that she took too much and drowned or took too much and, you know, overdosed.
Okay. Seems like a reasonable thought process. Mm-hmm.
Tybee Police Detective Corporal Bob Bryson, who is currently the chief of police in Tybee, though I think he's about to retire. I saw that we're going to have a woman police chief.
Okay. Yeah. Moving forward.
Yeah.
Getting with the times.
Yeah.
As long as they keep the little program where they have the dogs and the cars with the cops, that's all I care about.
They do. He arrived at the O'Shaughnessy house to find Joni with her head under the faucet side of the tub in a few inches of water with her long hair and her teeth. First of all,
I've
never seen anyone take a bath, put their head on the side where the faucet is. That's just odd to me.
That is odd. I'm sure people might do that, but I have never done it.
I mean, it just seems like you would hit your head on it.
Yeah, and it'd be in the way or the water would be splashing on you and stuff. You want it at your feet.
Mm-hmm.
So you can throw your bubble bath in there.
Your bath bombs.
Yeah, those.
Tybee police aren't used to investigating deaths such as this. The most recent homicide prior to this possible homicide occurred in 1993 during the Orange Crush Festival where a man was shot. Detective Bryson called in the Chatham County Police Forensic Unit.
Sounds like a smart move.
Chatham County Coroner James Metz
told Detective Bryson that this was a possible homicide. The forensics team assessed the scene. They found the hammer outside the bathroom along with splintered wood that Owen claimed Joni had used to smash a hole in the bedroom door that night. And there was also a metal broom handle on the floor. The bathroom was in disarray for the most part. There was water on the floor. A set of keys lay next to the tub. A red plaid shirt was hanging on the side of the tub. On the floor was a pair of blue jean shorts, and oddly, a bottle of spray cleaner was laying on top of the shorts.
That does seem kind of weird.
Yeah. If she's taking a bath, why does she have spray cleaner on?
Why would she care? Why would there be a shirt on the side of the bathtub?
It was probably her shirt she laid. It's like a bathtub, you know, with like the surround. So you could put stuff on the side. It's not just a freestanding. Yes. Yeah.
I'm thinking of like one of those old timey claw type foots where it's like, it's just a ledge.
If I'm not mistaken, because of the picture I've seen of her mother holding a picture of her sitting in the tub, it has a side to it. So you could set stuff on it.
Okay.
So I'm assuming she just put her shirt on the side when she took it off.
Okay.
There was a pack of cigarettes and a lighter on the toilet with a candle still burning next to them. This is one of those candles you see at the grocery store, the tall with the Virgin Mary on it.
Okay.
So it's still lit. Chatham County Police Captain Bob Merriman speculated the bathroom scene may have been staged. He is quoted as saying, quote,
"You look at the photographs of the bathroom. She had a bathroom that was in disarray except for right around the toilet area where it looks like everything was pristinely put there," he said. "The candle, which was left burning, everything else was pretty much cleaned up around it. We found out there were no prints on what looked like the whole area over there. That toilet area had been wiped down," he said. "I don't think they were trying to destroy evidence. I just think because of the fact that the suspect was in fact O'Shaughnessy, then you would expect to find his prints there. It's just that for whatever reason, it seemed like this particular area had been cleaned as opposed to the other areas, almost like a memorial was set up as an afterthought."
End quote. So most interesting to me is when they lifted Joni's body out of the tub, they found the doctor's SunTrust debit card that he had used earlier that night at McDonough's bar.
Call back.
He had last claimed that it was in his front shirt pocket. And he had no explanation as to how it could have gotten into the tub under her body.
That is probably one of the key things in this entire story that really doesn't make sense to fit with the narrative that I think they ended up coming out with.
Yeah. Like, first of all, why would she have cleaner in the bathroom while she's going to take a bath? Like, if she's like, you know, all amped up and she's like, I got to relax, I'm going to take a bath, light a candle and get in the bathtub.
Why get some cleaner out?
Why is the cleaner on top of her shorts?
And on top of this, you want to reiterate the fact that it's assumed that when she went to take this bath, she was in some sort of drunken rage and had some effects of drugs or alcohol or both in her system. So clearly she wouldn't be thinking clearly.
Yeah, like why do I need to clean?
To start with.
Yeah.
So
I don't think cleaning would be your first thing you would think to do.
Maybe it would be for you.
Honestly, I do clean.
You take your cleaning seriously.
I do clean the shower sometimes while I'm taking a shower.
Yeah. Doesn't sometimes, surprise me.
But not if I was taking pills and drugs. That probably would not be what I would want to do.
I wouldn't think it, but I also wouldn't be surprised.
The timeline where we talked about Owen says he came home and went to bed at midnight and that she was out till 3:30. Well, this was a later version of his story. In initial interviews, he claimed they started arguing when they got home from Savannah, which would have been around 11:30. He stated that Joni had tried to attack him with the hammer instead of busting the door. It was in later interviews that he changed his story to the fight occurring after 3:30 a.m. Maybe he was just confused about the time if he was woken up in the middle of the night.
Did he have a lawyer?
Not at that time.
Because I'm about to say, I don't think a lawyer is going to allow him to come in here with multiple different versions of the story, even if it's not intentionally being misleading.
He was never arrested.
So he didn't think he needed a lawyer.
Right. And this was just them questioning him, trying to find out what happened.
Public service announcement just for anyone listening. If the police ever want to talk to you for any reason whatsoever, even if they don't act like you're a suspect, if they're talking to you, mm-hmm. you're a suspect,
yes.
no matter what it is.
Yeah, so
always get a lawyer.
Get a lawyer. But so maybe he was confused, but they do, you know, she was alive till 3:30 because she was seen out by multiple people. So I don't know why he would say.
And everyone on this island knows everyone else.
Right.
It's all the locals know each other. So you're going to notice people out and you'll see them, even though there are a lot of people out in the summer months with a lot of tourists and stuff. You still see the same people all the time and you see them, you nod at them, you might not talk to them, but you recognize their presence.
Yeah, and so several people knew she was out there. Detective Bryson notes in his report that, quote,
I then asked Dr. O'Shaughnessy if he had murdered his wife, and he began to cry. I asked him again, how did he kill her? He replied that he didn't kill her. I told him that it appears to be a domestic violence homicide.
And see, I'm not defending him. Like, I don't know what happened. But the thing is, the police can try to shift what you're thinking. Like, did you see how he went from, did you kill her, to how did you kill her? Yeah. And
well, police are trained to get confessions.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, regardless, they're just like, because, you know, I assume a lot of people just bite on that. And I'm not saying that he was trying to be willfully directing
he just
him towards
the truth.
A confession,
yeah.
But that is how they're trained to interact
yeah,
with people.
And I think he probably believed he did kill her and he wanted to know why and how.
Yeah, because who else would have?
Mm-hmm. Unless it
was an accident, which is entirely possible.
It is possible. The county coroner, James Metz, officially ruled Joni's death a homicide on September 24th, 2002. So that's about a little over a month later, month and a half.
Yeah.
In a statement to WTOC, he said, quote,
it is my opinion that she was suffocated, then manually suffocated with the hand over the nose and over the mouth, that she was held underwater in the bathtub while this was done.
Owen claimed that James Metz was a friend of Joni's family and should not have been involved in the investigation.
Seems like that could be a conflict of interest.
Right. I think this is why they brought in the GBI.
Okay.
So the Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
The Freds.
So they were brought in to perform an autopsy, and the ruling was, quote, drowning complicated by acute lorazepam and alcohol intoxication, end quote. However, when it came to the manner of death, it was ruled undetermined. So they basically reversed his homicide.
Just totally 180.
Right.
So if the guy wasn't being willfully misstating what happened, which I don't think a lot of people would do that, even if they were friends.
Oh, no.
So there had to be some kind of evidence towards what he was saying, you would think.
I think the drugs and the alcohol highly complicate how someone could drown. Because, if a woman is just going to take a bath and there's nothing in her system, it's unlikely she's going to drown.
In a few inches of water.
Right. And if she is, then you can't say for sure someone else held her underwater unless you have some other evidence. Like
it seems like
the debit card under her body.
Evidence. Like, you know, if you're, unless somebody's passed out and you're trying to drown them, mm-hmm. it seems like there would be some sort of evidence of like skin under her fingernails.
We're going to talk about that in a second.
Things like that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Joni's blood alcohol content was 0.099. The legal limit is 0.08. So that's not
significantly higher than, not enough to make you pass out and drown, I wouldn't think.
No, especially for someone who drinks regularly. I don't think she would have been.
Yeah, a lot of people around here, that's probably their normal blood alcohol
any
content,
time of
just
the day.
Existing.
Yeah, know? Like she may have been slightly buzzed, but I don't think she would have even been like incoherent from the alcohol.
It's probably other substances involved with the alcohol that might make a difference.
Yeah, it is determined that she had ingested the entire bottle of 30 lorazepam tablets. However, most of them were still in her stomach and had not had time to absorb into her bloodstream.
So when you say you OD, say you take a whole bunch of pills and then you die, or let's say you drink, whatever, it's not the pills that go through, you decease after you've taken these. Does your body stop processing stuff in your stomach at that point?
It did, yeah. That's why it had not had time to metabolize into her system and it didn't continue to metabolize.
It seems like it'd be like a time capsule almost to look in somebody's stomach to try to figure things out.
Right.
Is that something they do in forensics a lot?
Yeah, because so if you took the pills and they're not, it would not have time to incapacitate her.
Which seems like a very big deal in this particular case.
But I didn't read if she had any other drugs in her system. So
she might have already had.
Well, it doesn't say that she did. So she probably didn't. I mean,
seems like
had,
an autopsy would have like released results
that, right.
of that nature.
Like if she had met up with the lady and gotten cocaine or whatever,
you would see it in the system.
Oxycontin, yeah.
And then the sleeping pills or the Valium would be irrelevant because. Yeah, maybe it might have ended up being the cause of death, but it didn't get to that point, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it didn't get to the point where it could have killed her.
Did it get to the point where it could have knocked her out, though?
They said that it was therapeutic levels in her body, so no.
Even mixed with alcohol?
Yeah.
Okay.
Especially for someone who takes it on a regular basis. It's not someone who's never had lorazepam and you...
So
like,
that's something you can build a tolerance.
Like
I guess any drug you can build
I ever,
a tolerance to.
Right. The first time I ever tried to take OxyContin after a surgery.
Yeah, you felt like your heart was going to explode.
Yeah, I felt
crazy.
Like,
I'd rather just feel the pain from the surgery.
Yeah, so for me, one pill could have knocked me out at that time. But
and then when you had kidney stones, you took a couple of them and it didn't even affect you because you were dying from the pain.
Yeah, so it affects people differently. But for her, I don't think, you know, a couple tablets of lorazepam would have incapacitated her and caused her to drown. Yeah. James Metz, the coroner, remained resolute in his belief that this was a homicide. However, the Chatham County District Attorney's Office was not as convinced.
Do you think that if they had not found the debit card, do you think that's the big reason that maybe pushes them to thinking, well, this doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem like something that would the other stuff maybe coincidentally could have happened. Maybe she did light a candle. Maybe she did put all her stuff cleaning supplies out here because people do weird things when they're high and drunk. Mm-hmm. They do. I know from experience, people will just do strange things. I have done strange things when I've had too much to drink in the past. Lost a lot of money in Vegas that way.
That's true.
But do you think if they had not found that debit card, that it would have influenced their initial thoughts or the fact that it may be a homicide? Because it just seems like a weird piece of information that
for me,
doesn't make sense.
That is the most thing that would make me think twice about it. Like the other stuff, I could be like, okay, well, maybe this could have been.
It's enough for reasonable doubt. It wouldn't be enough to convict anybody if they said, oh, this is going to be a murder
right.
trial.
These are all circumstantial, but yeah, for me.
Well, even that would be circumstantial, but it would just be weird, right?
Because he has no explanation as to how it got there.
Has anyone been convicted of murder under solely circumstantial evidence?
I think so, yeah. I mean, you can be convicted, but it has to be a lot of, like, because honestly, what if it was a suicide and she wanted to frame him.
Yeah.
And she went in the room and found his debit card in his pocket because he did not wear that shirt, according to Jennifer. Yeah. So what if she took it in there and put it down in the tub I mean, we just don't know.
Possibility. I mean, you never know how people's thought processes are working.
So I'm not saying at all that that's what happened, but I'm saying that a defense attorney is going to bring that up, and they knew this in the, you know, the district attorney's office. Okay. So they said, district attorney Spencer Lawton was quoted as saying, quote,
"We did not present it to the grand jury because there was, in my opinion, not even what we call probable cause that it was not an accident, which is what we would have to do."
Right. So he's just saying, like, despite all these circumstances, there's just no way.
It's just not enough.
Yeah, there's not enough. Unfortunately, if he did, you know, that's sad that there's no justice for her. But
yeah,
I mean, what are you going to do?
We want to clarify that we don't know if it's a murder or suicide, and we're not trying to push it one way or the other.
Even an accident.
Or even just an unintentional, horrific accident. Mm-hmm.
There were no defensive wounds on her body. The only noted injury was a small red spot above her left eye that seemed to be a bruise.
Okay.
But what if she hit her head on the faucet since she's...
It's possible.
Yeah, maybe she did just fall.
Anything could have
honestly
happened.
I've fallen in the past week. I've fallen a few times, so I can understand how
dogs were involved in some of it.
In some of it. But I mean, sometimes people fall.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no way to prove it. The doctor was photographed in the days after the death, and they found no wounds or scratches on his body. And it doesn't appear that they tested her fingernails for skin cells that could have been under her nails if she had tried to fight off an attack. So that, to me, is weird. Why would you not? If you're doing an autopsy, why not
check for everything? Every available
especially
possibility
if you
for
suspect
evidence.
This could be a murder. Seems like you would definitely check under her nails.
Maybe if this same thing happened today, and we do have advanced technology in DNA, so they might have done this a little bit more stringently recently because they know how much more evidence they can get of things.
And honestly, if his DNA was found under her fingernails, I still don't think that would have been enough probable cause because
they're around each other all the time.
Could have gotten there any way. I mean, she could touch him on his arm.
He could have like scratched her.
Or she could have scratched his arm or anything. Yeah. Like, you know, she.
Any normal amount of contact.
Yeah. So I don't, it's not a stranger's DNA under your nails. So I don't even think that would have been enough.
Yeah.
So they brought in Dr. Brian Frist, a forensic pathologist, and he's from Marietta, and this was his statement.
"The fingernails are kind of long, and they aren't broken or anything. And if she was being choked or held down, she would resist. There is no evidence of that. She would have grabbed the person who was choking her or pressing her down, and she would break those nails."
Yeah, so that may be true, but it's just speculation either way.
Yeah, and you got to have hard evidence if you want to bring murder charges against somebody.
Mm-hmm. And often if she had been, like, if he had been holding her by the neck or whatever, when you die, the skin will discolor at times. Like, so.
And it just stays that way, right?
It would stay that way. Or petechial hemorrhaging in her eyes.
I don't know what that means.
They're little broken blood vessels that often happen if you've been choked or, you know, so, they don't have any of that.
And somebody doing an autopsy would have seen stuff like that even then.
You would think.
Oh, this is a, although would it look like bloodshot eyes?
Well, it would be little red dots.
Okay, so it doesn't look like a normal kind of thing you might have with like an allergic reaction or something. It's some specific looking thing.
Dr. Frist could not conclude that this death was a homicide based on the evidence that he reviewed. He said, quote,
"It's a stretch for someone to force someone to take the drugs, and it is not possible to make someone ingest drugs after death."
Yeah, so that's another thing. How would he have made her take all those pills?
Yeah, it would be difficult.
Right. I mean, to like force pills down someone's throat is a lot, especially you're talking about 3:30, 4 in the morning. He's probably, you know, he's probably tired.
It would be extremely difficult. It'd have to be like a crime of passion because if he had intended to murder somebody, if that was his plan and something he did, I think a man like him would think it out a little better and maybe plan it in a more.
We think that, but we don't know. So, I mean, maybe he
did. If it's a crime of passion.
Yeah, but maybe he did.
maybe just assumed he would, if this is what happened, maybe just assumed that since he was a doctor that, you know, and she has this history of issues with
drugs.
They
wouldn't question it so much.
That maybe it might just go swept under the rug and not be as big a deal.
Well, this one is another thing that I found interesting. They found the empty bottle of lorazepam in the trash in the kitchen. Okay. So if you're going to
kill yourself, you're just going to throw the bottle like, where you are.
That's another thing. Like, if you're going to take the pills, are you going to walk all the way into the kitchen and then throw the bottle away?
But once again, this is you assuming how thought process works.
I know. Maybe she started out in the kitchen. Maybe that's where the pills were. She went in there, took them, threw it in the trash, and then went into the bathroom. So
could be.
There's just so many things you just, you know, will never know the answer to, most likely. So this case just has so many questions and we're likely never going to have answers. And although Owen O'Shaughnessy was never indicted for murdering his wife, the original coroner's belief that he was responsible was enough to convince Joni's family and most residents of Tybee. In the months following his wife's death, he lost many of his patients and moved into the medical clinic. He is quoted as saying,
"When I realized she was dead, I knew that life would never be the same again. But more than that, I knew that my life, in a sense, was over. I had found happiness with Joni that I had never known before."
And he also said,
"There has been absolutely no talk about what else it could have been. It's all been focused on murder." "The coroner was wrong," said Dr. O'Shaughnessy. "This was not a crime. This was a dreadful accident that has left everyone who knew Joni heartsick with grief. That is awful to have her family grow suspicious and remove themselves from me," he said. "To be doubted by her friends, to be doubted by my own patients is horrible."
So this really is a horrible situation either way, because either he did murder her and didn't get any repercussions
it was a horrible accident.
Or if it was an accident.
But everyone just is like painting him as a horrible person.
It was like, it's so hard because you just really don't know. And so he had moved into the clinic, like I said, and he had plans to build on top of it and turn it into condominiums, but that never happened. As for Joni's mother, Becky Crawford, she believed Owen was responsible for her daughter's death. She said in the days following the death, Owen told her, quote, "I don't know. Do you think I could have done it and don't remember?" And she says, "Hell yeah, I think he could have done it and not remember." So, I mean, she was convinced.
Not a big fan.
And she knew him, and she said that her daughter
thought he was capable of,
Yeah, she said that Joni was afraid of him in the months prior. Troubles followed him the rest of his life. He had borrowed $32,000 from Joni's mother to buy the clinic back in the 90s, and she sued him for it in 2007. Also in 2007, his medical license was revoked following accusations of illegal drug use and repeatedly prescribing OxyContin to patients without, quote, "a diagnosis necessitating the prescription of a controlled substance."
Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah. The medical board also found that he had failed to comply with conditions they had placed on him in 2004 regarding problems with his practice. He was supposed to comply with the following, according to an article in Savannah Now. So these are the things he was supposed to do. Complete a mini residency called Appropriate Prescribing of Controlled Substances and submit documentation of attendance.
Seems like if a man had a medical license, that seems kind of rudimentary.
Well, because he wasn't doing it, so they were making him go to this class.
Oh, I'm not supposed to just give everybody OxyContin. I was confused.
Right. Needs to be reiterated. He was also supposed to take 20 hours of medical education on, quote, "boundary violations" and submit documentation of attendance. The order did not define the term, but in general, it covers inappropriate interactions between physicians and patients.
Seems like an odd thing to just pop up.
No, there were rumors that he was having an inappropriate relationship with with patients.
Oh, no.
So they were.
We had a dentist like that.
Remember
that?
No, it wasn't our dentist. It was our physician.
Oh, seems like our dentist had issues too.
What dentist?
It was our doctor.
It was the doctor.
Yeah, he went to jail.
Yeah, he went to jail. And I think he's still there.
He went to jail for a while.
Yeah, I think he's still there.
He might even be his own true crime case.
He may be. He was also supposed to have a doctor supervise him, you know, his practice, and review 10% of his medical charts on a quarterly basis and submit reports. Didn't happen. He was also diagnosed with bipolar that he had been treating himself, like we said earlier.
So someone else diagnosed him?
No. What I'm saying is he was supposed to get another doctor to verify him. And to begin treat him and monitor his prescriptions and progress, but he didn't do that.
Yeah.
So none of these things happened. He didn't do one thing from 2004 to 2007. He was also charged with felony possession of marijuana following a raid on his office by the Chatham Savannah Counter Narcotics Team.
Does not seem like something that you would want to have on your medical property.
Right. He ended up pleading guilty to the charges of felony possession of marijuana and was deported to Ireland in 2008.
He was deported because of the marijuana felony or a combination of other things?
No, because if you are an immigrant and you are convicted of, or plead guilty to a felony, you can be deported.
Ah.
Yeah, so you can't. You got to be careful.
Did not know that.
Tony's mother's response to his incarceration and subsequent deportation was, quote, "I'm to the point now that I really don't care about that. Nothing is going to bring her back." He hated Ireland. He called it the black hell. So she was kind
of, I guess, in her opinion,
he can go back there.
Maybe not the punishment she thinks he deserved, but the punishment that he didn't want.
Right. So some sort of justice, a little, just a little, maybe.
Assuming justice was needed.
Assuming that he did do it. See, this is a picture of her with her daughter's picture in the tub. Do you see what I mean?
That's the bathtub?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I believe so. And so you can see where there could have been things sitting on the side of the tub.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Charles Owen O'Shaughnessy died February 27, 2009, at age 64 in Ireland after a battle with viral encephalitis. Encephalitis is inflammation of the brain.
Mm.
It can manifest as flu-like symptoms, and it can be fatal in some cases, such as his.
Okay.
So that's a sad ending to a sad story, and we're likely never going to find out what really happened that night. And it sounds like Jody was very well loved, and I know her friends and family still miss her. Now I want to read from an online memorial that I found for her. "In loving memory of Joni O'Shaughnessy, it has been 6 empty years since you left and went away, and the rocking gray and horror still sheaths the world in gray. We have faith from signs you left us that you've gone to take your rest. In that small but fiercely brilliant band of those who were in their time the very best of all humankind." And that was published in 2008 in the Savannah Morning News.
That's very poetic.
It is nice. And a couple of people wrote under there a few little sentiments. "Your spirit moved me, and I will fulfill my promise to tell your story. The angels continue to lift you up as you shower us with love and continue to inspire. Everlasting peace be with you." And Joni was indeed one of the best, the most beautiful, gifted, and loved.
Okay, so thank you for your hard work on this episode. This is a true crime story. We haven't really done a semi-recent one in a while, and on the back of the Alec Murdoch case that we talked about. So let us know the feedback, how you like about these more modern true crime stories. We're still going to do them whether you like them or not, but I would like to hear your feedback.
Yeah, the Alec Murdoch was pretty popular, so we're wanting to add that. Probably
there's a lot more going on with it.
There's so many things, and the trial is coming up.
Yeah, that's definitely
really soon, like a couple weeks.
Some probably interesting stuff fall out from that, I imagine.
And so if you want more of that, go on to our Patreon, because we're going to add in some episodes for that.
And we hope to have more updates for this episode as well, because we've contacted some people that are knowledgeable about this story, and are waiting to see if we can get some response. And if we do, we will come back and give some updates later from people that maybe were close to the actual event of the story.
Right. We just couldn't get it in time. So we will hopefully have an update on
this. That's what deadlines do to you. They do that to you. Even when you got 2 weeks to write a podcast, we still somehow got to wait on other people. But hopefully they'll be generous enough with their time to get back with us and we can update the story as needed. Check out our Patreon to learn more about other things. We started a new series on Patreon ghosts.
It was fun.
And we're going to be talking about ghosts on top of the cryptids we talk about. Maybe we're going to switch it off and change it up, but it's an interesting ghost story about the Phantom of Ridgeway. And it is known as one of the few ghosts in history that has supposedly actually killed somebody.
I know. I didn't know they could kill.
It was a good story, I think.
It was good.
So that's going to bring us to the portion of our show where we...
insert graphic here.
Fabulous.
I almost missed it.
What we're watching. So this week, we've been watching something, not one episode, but, you know, Crystal's got us hooked on these cooking shows, and they're on 24/7, and we randomly started one, and it's been on for multiple seasons, and we like just sort of skipped to a, not the most recent season.
It was last year.
But it was last year's, and this show is called The Worst Cooks in America.
Yeah.
And this one had stars from 90s, not just sitcoms, but various things from the 90s, like movies, like Clueless, had Jodie Sweetin on it, mm-hmm. who, you know, is definitely entertaining to listen to her talk when she cooks, because she sort of has a mental breakdown when she's cooking like I would.
Yeah.
She just like, she stands there like a statue and laments the food choices she's made. It's a show that features what they call the worst cooks in America trying to take classes, so to speak, from two chefs. And there's two teams. One of the chefs is named Ann Burrell.
She's a very famous
and
chef.
And she's the one that is basically the main host, and she's on every season. And then apparently every season they have a guest chef for the other team. And that particular one had, what's his name?
Jeff Morrow,
who I think is hilarious.
Yeah.
I like
him.
He's
the sandwich king.
He is the sandwich king. So
he has his own show.
I like him. He's funny. But they work with their teams, trying to take them from absolute garbage cooks to someone who can cook a passable three-course dinner meal that is served to chefs at a restaurant. So they judge who actually turns out to be a decent cook. And the season that we watched, it actually turned out where they did it. They made a lot of progress.
They did.
So, Crystal, tell me how you feel about this show.
Well, you know, I love any kind of baking, cooking show. So,
I'm going to give it anything.
I'm going to give that season an 11 out of 12.
It was good.
The new season just started, so they've only had one episode, and it's not celebrities.
We haven't watched that one yet.
Yeah, we started it. It's influencers, TikTok, and all that.
It's just not as interesting without the celebrities, I don't think.
Well, the other one we're watching is also Normal People, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, they're good.
Yeah, it just, you have to get into it. I think you got to give it a couple episodes to get familiarized with the people.
Yeah, so, and then you have a tie to them, like I did with Mark.
You really wanted Mark to stay.
From that season, and now you just said that Mark didn't stay, so Mark didn't win,
you know,
but we won't tell you who won. Go watch it. My review of this series, and focusing specifically on the 90s season, is that I'm going to give it a 10 out of 12 because it's interesting seeing these people. It had a
Lori Beth Ginsburg. Not Ginsburg. Lori
It had Lori Beth from All That, which is a show I used to watch in the
90s. I can't remember it right now.
She's funny. They're all funny.
Is it Ginsburg?
I don't know.
It might be.
She's correcting me, and we don't even know.
I don't know. I was just thinking Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Of course you were.
Maybe it was her.
She wasn't on the show.
She wasn't. No, she wasn't.
And she wasn't a 90s celebrity. Although I think she was born in the 1890s.
Maybe.
So check this show out if you enjoy cooking, unless you're like us and have it on 24/7 and it just randomly is on anyway. So you'll be able to see it.
Halloween Wars again while you're asleep.
Get ready for next year.
Yeah, I'm already ready for Halloween.
Or this year.
Yeah, it's this year. Yeah. See, I got to start taking down this Christmas stuff so I can get to the next holiday.
Get to work on it.
Which is Valentine's Day, and I did get some stuff last night to decorate with.
Nice.
Remember?
I do.
You were with me.
I was there.
Got the cute little conversation heart.
You fussed at me for how I put bleach on the cash register.
Well, we got 8 bottles of bleach, like we're serial killers.
Like a crazy person. I put more than one on the conveyor belt at a time. She's like, you don't have to do that. Well, she can scan it in the buggy.
She can scan
it. Or whatever it is she can
do. She can scan it once and put it in a quantity of 8.
I'm just trying to be helpful.
I know, but
I'm always trying to be helpful and always backfires. But of the two of us, I'm the one that did not leave their phone in the bathroom at the Home Depot.
That did
forcing us to turn around and fly back down the interstate at 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, which is very fast for me. I went 5 miles an hour over the speed limit.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
For a very short portion of the drive.
Oh, okay. So I didn't even notice
which
that.
Which is very fast for me.
Yeah, luckily you were tracking my phone with your phone and we could see that it wasn't moving.
It's still in the bathroom.
It's in the bathroom.
It's got some issues. So that's going to bring us to the portion of our show that we call Layla and Coffee Talk.
And Oscar.
Where's Oscar? We saw Oscar last night when we were driving home. We saw this thing in the road. And I think he recognized us because he ran out in the middle of the road and he stopped and he stood up like full, like a gopher or prairie dog. And then he turned around and ran off. I was like, Oscar!
Well, if you recall, he made a visit on Christmas.
He did. He is a very festive beast.
Yeah, we hadn't seen him in a while.
He looks like Krampus.
Christmas night, he showed up to eat
some
cat food.
Just to let us know he's still alive.
Yeah.
And we saw him last night.
Yeah, so he's good.
But this story pertains to the dogs, and it turns out Coffee's an attempted damager of Crystal as much as possible.
Now, we were on our walk the other night, and there's a section of the road back here that's very dark, especially in the off season. There's not a lot of lights. There's not a lot
of randomly people. Street lights are burnt out for no reason at
and
all.
And like the house lights on people's houses don't always come on. Like some places over there, they have the motion light that'll come on when we walk by, but
didn't come on that night.
It didn't. So we're walking along and all of a sudden she decides to stop right in front of me.
And Coffee is a very dark colored dog. So
yeah,
in the dark,
in.
You can't see her at all. Layla's blonde and she's as big as a horse. So it's easy to see her, but Coffee's just vanishes and you just see a leash moving around.
She blends in with the pavement. So.
Her nickname that we've given her is because
Zigzag.
That's sort of what the leash does when you got her. It's like you can hear it fly off.
So I fell over her. Fell on my knee, ripped my pants, and got my hand hurt, my arm. And
yeah, she's laying in the street, and I'm sitting here with two dog leashes, a bag of dog poop in one hand, and she's laying on the ground, hurting, and I'm like, I don't know what to do here.
And it's like, I didn't think I could walk. I didn't think I was going to be able to walk at first.
What am I going to do with this dog poop?
Oh, no, just throw it in the trash.
Just throw it on the wall.
Someone's trash. I don't know. But
I disposed of it responsibly.
You did. But I luckily it was minor. I just got a scraped knee. My hand was sore for a couple of days. My arm is sore a little bit.
Good times.
But then I almost re-injured my foot today.
Yeah, it fell asleep and then she thought she broke every bone in it just by standing up. So it turns out she's a danger to herself.
Well, I went to take a step and every bone in my foot cracked and I think it was just popping. I guess that's what it was doing.
Well, hopefully our next episode, we won't be talking about how Coffee injured you in some other way.
Yeah,
she works.
She's trying to get rid of me.
At some point, one of us is going down the steps. I know that much.
Oh, I did fall down the stairs.
I'm laying the groundwork right now for it to happen so that when people are like, what happened to Brett? I'd be like, well, the dog knocked him down the stairs.
Well, if that did happen, that would not be unusual because
I'd be like, well, I just figured that's how I was going
to
go.
If you try to go down the stairs, they have to go too, and they go barreling down
and
they
don't
knock
wait
you.
For you. They go by you. And if you're in the way,
they'll
especially with Layla, she's like, she just takes your legs out and goes. Mm-hmm. And she's big enough to do it.
I did fall down the stairs over Christmas. I was going down the stairs and my sock slipped out from under me. Luckily, like our stairs go down and then they turn to the
right. Luckily, she was caught by a wall.
Yeah, like it goes down and has to turn to the right. And so I was at the very, like there was one more step. So I slid into the wall.
Yeah.
It was fine.
Well, I'm glad you survived.
And I also fell in the living room. There was a spot of water for some reason. I don't know why. It was just a little spot of water. And I'm just walking through the living room at normal speed. And my foot hits the water. And I fall down again. So I'm just...
There goes Crystal again.
I need to be very careful with myself, apparently.
It seems like you've lost your equilibrium.
That's the fourth time I've injured myself in the past 3 weeks.
You are truly a threat to yourself.
And I can't believe that it's not something like me climbing on a ladder.
Oh, that's going to happen.
Or a chair. Or
the
countertop
probably
or something.
Probably putting these Christmas decorations up. You're going to hurt yourself again somehow.
Of.
And our next episode is going to be you're laying in a bed in a full body cast.
Well, we got a bed right here. You can just turn the
camera. Just turn the camera. What do you think, Crystal? And you went, because your face will be covered with bandages. If you want to find us online, you can go to ScarySavannahAndBeyond.com. You can also find us on all social media at username @ScarySavannah. please go ahead and go check out our Patreon, because that's where we've got the new stuff, like the story about the ghost. We're going to be updating it with true crime updates, possibly some updates of previous stories we've covered over our long time of doing this so far.
Yeah, we're going to have those updates. There's nothing new happening on the Lake Mead front at the moment. I checked that out.
So. Yeah, it's still there.
Yeah.
For now.
They haven't found the identities of any of the other bodies yet that I found.
So. But we'll get updates when there they do, as we'll they update happen. That. Go to patreon.com/scarysavannah. Not only can you get exclusive content, you can help support our podcast, which would be greatly appreciated. A reminder, we are on a bi-weekly schedule, so our next episode will be out in 2 weeks, but we release Patreon episodes at least once a week. So you can hear us every week if you go do that on Sundays at 8 p.m. Also, to help support the podcast, if you could help Crystal's caffeine-fueled self-damaging rage by going to our website and clicking on the little yellow icon in the bottom left-hand corner and donating coffees to the podcast. It's very much appreciated to those who can and who have, but please keep that espresso cup full.
Yeah, espresso is my drink of choice right now.
We drink so much of it, we burn out the coffee grinder, apparently.
Already? We've only had it a month.
It's only been a month. So we got a new one from Cuisinart heading this way. And if it works out, hopefully we can get squeeze us out of Cuisinart sponsorship.
Yeah, come on, Cuisinart.
Cuisinart, where you at? So that brings us to the portion of the podcast where Crystal has words to say and I react to them.
Join us next time in Savannah, where the ghosts and the good times live on.
But you know who don't?
Who?
It might be you if we keep walking them dogs on a dark street.
I know. I might be the next
in episode. The dark of the night. Who's going to be talking about Crystal? It seems that the dog was a little bit too much of a zigzag. Well, we'll talk to you next week when she's in a full body cast.
Thanks again for listening to True Crime by Indie Drop-In Network. If you would like to nominate a true crime podcast to be featured, just send me a tweet at Indie Drop-In. I'd also love to hear if one of our featured podcasts is now your favorite show. Indie Drop-In survives off ad revenue and listener donations. If you would like to contribute, please consider buying me a coffee. You can go to buymeacoffee.com/IndieDropIn. If you look at the very bottom of the episode description, I put a link in there to make it really easy. Indie Drop-In has many other shows that you also might like. Just go to IndieDropIn.com. All right, see you next week.